From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A massive hurricane blows ashore as the race for the White House goes into its final week. A wild card at the end of an intense race. And there's another wild card out there, the possibility of a tie in the Electoral College, 269-269. No winner on Election Day, and Congress voting for the president. The Constitution is clear on the process, but what would the reality look like this hour on Point if the election produces a tie? What then? You can join the conversation. Can you picture it? The day after voting day and no winner. The tension, the pressures, the process. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're setting up the election tie scenarios today. As we do, of course, Hurricane Sandy bearing down on the eastern seaboard. That is a wild scenario, too. We'll go to the Electoral College tie. But first, Sandy and the election. Peter Baker is in Washington with the New York Times. He's been writing about how the big hurricane could shake up the home stretch and the vote. Peter Baker, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. So already it's changing candidate schedules.
Yeah, it is. The president was in Florida this morning for a rally in Orlando, suddenly decided to change his plans and hopped on Air Force One, is on his way back to Washington right now. He left behind Bill Clinton to lead that campaign event. Also just scrubbed tomorrow's rally in Green Bay, Wisconsin due to the storm. Governor Romney's also had to change his schedule over the last few days because of this. So, you know, it's already screwing up everybody's, carefully laid out methodical plans for these final days of the campaign.
Well, how do you read the impact of that? Mitt Romney has been on this momentum jag since the first debate and been pushing that hard and working it before big crowds, not to have this last week when President Obama, by many electoral counts, may still have the edge there. Does this hurt Romney more, Obama more? Can you tell?
Well, I tell you, you can get every answer to that question you want, and everybody's got a different interpretation. I think they're all probably completely guesswork. I mean, you can you can play it out as here's the president who's going to be in the commander-in-chief mode. Does that help him because he looks more presidential, or does it hurt him because, you know, he might get blamed for not being more effective? Does it hurt because the swing states like Virginia are most affected? Does it stop early voting that the Obama campaign thought was good for them? Does it freeze the debate? Does it freeze the debate at a moment when Romney did seem to have momentum? Does it prevent the candidates from having their closing arguments heard as much as they thought? Or, as somebody I saw just the other just a little while ago wrote, does it mean people are actually going to be sitting at home and watching more television and seeing more campaign ads? So it's a complete jump ball, I'd say.
I mean, watching more television if they've got power, if the TV's not dark, which it could be after all the money that's been spent here.
Absolutely right. Exactly right. So maybe all that money for those ads in the last few days will be completely wasted. Nobody really knows. Anybody tends to know is really just guessing at this point.
It's hitting the East Coast. Now, there are a lot of blue states up in the Northeast. There are blue or red states when you get down to Virginia and North Carolina. Who knows? Does the fact that it's hitting the East Coast mean an impact, or does that change the electoral map?
Well, I think we have to wait and see. I mean, it's obviously still 8 days away from an election, so the storm will have passed by the time Election Day comes. But some of these places could still be without power. There could be, a lot of difficulties that diminish voting. Certainly, historically, Republicans have done better with bad weather because their voters tend to be more determined to vote. And so that's something that's, of great concern in the Obama campaign headquarters today. But I don't think they're worried that they're going to suddenly lose blue states in the Northeast. I think they're much more concerned about Virginia, obviously, and any impact further inland, perhaps in Ohio.
What about early voting, which might have gone on this week? How much of that is there, or would there have been? Does it affect much, Peter?
Well, I think it does, obviously. You know, nobody's going to be going out today to early vote, at least in the quarter of the storm. And the Obama people were very, very high on this notion that they were winning the early vote, that the early vote was going to increase their overall take, because if Democrats find it more difficult necessarily to show up on a single election day, they benefit by having, more days of options to get to the early voting stations. So, you know, the president, I was with him on last week when he went to Chicago to early cast his own early vote to make that point. So, you know, this is not what was in the Obama campaign playbook for these few days.
Of course, a lot of the states that are said to be right in, most in the path of the storm don't have early voting. Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey. So not a factor there.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So it's a very, very selective situation.
What about the ground game? If we're all tangled up in downed trees and wires, you know, does that mess up, I don't know, voters, buses full of voters?
Well, they would have liked to have done more of these dry runs for forget out the vote drives, getting volunteers out to people's houses. I mean, at this point, we're getting people, volunteers to people's houses, presumably to help them, you know, get past broken tree limbs and get out of places without flooding or without power. So it certainly changes the dynamics in that sense. But again, you know, we're still 8 days out, and we got to be careful about overstating how this is going to play out. We thought, you know, the Republican convention got delayed by a day by a hurricane, but in the end, it didn't really change anything all that significant. Similarly, the president had to cancel his big open stadium speech at his convention because of weather. But
right.
I don't think, again, it really changed all that much. So we'll see.
Of course, here we are right on the brink of the voting itself. You're in Washington, Peter. How's it look there? Is it hunkered down?
Everybody's hunkered down. There's not a lot, very few people in the streets, very few businesses open. The federal government's closed down. The schools are closed down. Most people are battening down the hatches and hunkering down at home.
Peter Baker with the New York Times watching Hurricane Sandy come ashore just a week and a day before Election Day. Peter, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for me. Thanks very much for me. Take care.
You bet. All right. To the Electoral College tie scenario, there are half a dozen different ways it could happen next week. And if it does, what then? Joining me now from Washington is Amy Walter, political director for ABC News. She's all over this race and eventualities. Amy Walter, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you with us, Amy, in storm-ready Washington, D.C.
And from, you can say ready. Storm-battered.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, storm-battered. And from a little inland, a little further from all that sandy wrath, from Ada, Ohio, is Robert Alexander, chair of the Department of History, Politics, and Justice at Ohio Northern University. He's author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College, an examination of lobbying, wavering electors, and campaigns for faithless voters. Professor Alexander, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Okay, you guys, Amy, you're watching right now, and Robert, you know the history of this going way back. Amy, first of all, I mean, I'm looking here at people saying there are half a dozen different ways you could slice this that would literally end up with a 269 to 269 electoral college vote on Election Day. It may be a remote possibility, but that is such a kind of mind-boggling possibility that we want to look at it. Everybody hopes it does not happen because it's just too unsettling. But how could it happen, Amy?
Well, you're exactly right that there are lots of different scenarios to get to the 269, and the fact that we have such a tight race. I mean, if you look at any of the national polls as well as the state polls, I mean, this thing is just right on a knife's edge. So the idea that you could have one state go to one candidate by, you know, just a few thousand votes is not only a probability, it's most likely to happen. So I think, though, Tom, that there's more, the more likely possibility, though, right now, and one that I think also would create a great deal of havoc, is the possibility of having a popular vote winner and an electoral vote winner. And while this does not create the same sort of, you know, dynamics that a tied electoral college would mean. Of course, we'll talk about faithless electors and the impact of how Congress would work in that sense. But I think if you did have a popular vote winner, an electoral vote winner, it would look very similar to where we were in 2000, with a good chunk of the country believing that the president who was elected was there is not qualified to be the president because
looking back, you know, to Bush v. Gore, when Al Gore won popular, President Bush got it from the Supreme Court and that decision on Florida, and that was it, without
exactly
a popular majority. But he was president.
That's exactly right.
If you have that kind of split, we'll look at the tie. But if you've got that kind of split, popular vote one way, electoral college the other, which way is that likely to be?
Yeah, well, and it looks very different. You're right, Tom, than it did in 2000, where obviously Gore winning the popular vote. This time it would be that Mitt Romney would win the popular vote. I mean, if you look at our own national polling, the ABC Washington Post poll, and some of the others out there like Gallup, what you see is Mitt Romney with a very narrow lead, but a lead nonetheless. It's very narrow in ours. It's basically a tie. In Gallup, it's much more of a significant lead for Mitt Romney. But basically, it would come down to this, that Mitt Romney runs better in those red states, really runs up the score in some of those big red states like Texas, also down south, and then does better in some of those blue states, the New Jerseys and the Pennsylvanias and the Maine and all those places, even in Illinois, for example, than McCain did, and is able to narrow the percentage of victory that President Obama gets in those blue states. So he wins an outright majority of the popular vote. But if he loses places like Ohio, Virginia, Iowa, Wisconsin, very narrowly, he loses the electoral vote that goes to President Obama, and of course, as we know, then President Obama would be the president.
And there you've got the kind of cross-cut that caused so much angst in 2000, mm-hmm. but we can also imagine a lot of angst if this thing should go to a tie, and there are many ways that could happen. If the president loses most of the swing states that are up for grabs, Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Nevada, North Carolina, Virginia, could happen, but holds on to New Hampshire, Ohio, and Wisconsin, you've got an electoral vote of 269 to 269. Robert Alexander, has that ever happened before?
Actually, it has, and illustrated some of the flaws with the Electoral College right from the outset when the framers really did not recognize the idea of party tickets. And when Jefferson and Burr ran as a party ticket, you saw this problem exposed, and they deadlocked and did go to the contingency procedure. And that's really what necessitated that 12th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
And that's exactly where we would be at the 12th Amendment to the Constitution. The process is clear, but we all know how politics works. Things get gnarly in a hurry when that much pressure comes in. Robert Alexander, please stand by in Ohio. Amy Walter in Washington. We're looking with an eye on Hurricane Sandy at the possibility of another extreme and unusual event, the possibility of a tie in the Electoral College. Can you picture it? We wake up the morning after and are told it's a tie. 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are today with an eye on Hurricane Sandy, looking at the possibility of another extreme and unusual event, the possibility of a tie in the Electoral College in next week's presidential election, looking very closely at how that would be resolved. Amy Walter is with us. She's political director for ABC News, joins us today from Washington. Robert Alexander is here from Ohio Northern University, historian who's written in depth about the Electoral College and the many ways that things can go once they are large and in charge. And of course, they always technically are, but in a tie, that would become much more evident. Listeners, you can join us. Can you picture it? Waking up the morning after Election Day being told it's a tie. Obama, Romney, jump ball, 269 to 269, Congress to decide the winner. Can you imagine the tension, the machinations, the power plays, the temptation to work the system? What's your question about how this would really unfold? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. And Amy, I mean, everybody's got to hope this doesn't happen because it's just too weird. We don't want to get into a split popular vote and electoral vote. We certainly don't want to get into a tie where it just drifts, we see it drift right up away from the populace entirely and into the hands of Congress.
Right, into the hands of a Congress that I think now has maybe a double-digit approval rating. Maybe it's snuck up, I think, into like the 10% or 11%
approval. But it's been single-digit very recently.
Right. So the idea that this is the Congress that's going to do it, and as we know, the way that this works, or maybe some people actually don't know this, mm-hmm. because it's not something we have seen in modern times, but yes, it would go to, you know, first of all, we have the electors would all have to stay true to what the final electoral count is, and obviously Robert can go into that mm-hmm. in more detail about whether, you know, we would have, I think, a great deal of speculation about whether some of these electors would indeed go with or go against what their state popular vote was, right? And that could change the outcome.
Well, let's go straight to that. Robert, walk us through. We had this with back in Jefferson days, and it was so messy that they decided that we've got the 12th Amendment to deal with this. Technically, how does it work? We wake up the morning after, and then we see it looks like 269 to 269. What unfolds, Robert?
Well, I think as Amy was talking about, what you really have to focus on are those electoral votes are actually people. And that's something that we often forget. And that's where the crux of my research actually deals with, is the fact that trying to identify who the actual people would be who are charged with transmitting that popular vote into the electoral vote.
You know, I want to restrain you from the people angle for a minute. That's what's interesting. We know it's human. But walk us through the process, because people haven't seen this before. What's the calendar then of events that would happen? How does it unfold? According to the Constitution, what should happen?
Well, what you would find is that if it were indeed a tie, you would have the electors would meet, and let's just say that they all vote as anticipated, and it's indeed a tie.
When do they meet and vote? Is there a date for that?
I feel like it's December 19th this year. It's about a month after you and I vote, and during that time, that's when any kind of disputes would hopefully be settled. To transmit those electoral, or to transmit the popular vote to the actual electors.
But it's December. If we just pause on that for a second,
yeah.
We vote November 6th and into December, they still haven't formally had their vote in Congress. So we don't know who the next president is for
no.
all that time.
No, absolutely not. Okay. And you know, you go back recent American history back to 2000, and you know, it was pretty much unsure who the president was going to be for about a month there. And what you would find is that you'd probably have a number of recounts in a number of states, as Amy was talking about before. It's likely to be really, really close. And in states like Ohio, where there's been a lot of absentee ballots put out there, that you're likely to find that there'll be a lot of extra counting of the provisional ballots, trying to sort these things out. And if it's as close as people on the ground are looking at, we might not even be able to declare who actually won a state, let alone trying to figure out, you know, whether or not it's a tie or popular electoral college vote split.
And Amy, just to get you in here on that point, Amy, if it would look like a tie, I mean, all during the rest of November, presumably both parties would be trying like crazy to find some different count that would give them that one extra electoral vote. They'd want a recount here and a recount there, a recount everywhere, wouldn't they, Amy?
Well, and in some states, listen, there are rules in many states where there's an automatic recount if the vote is within a certain percentage. So those states are already going to have to go ahead and do that. In some states, they bar you, actually, from a recount. You cannot request one. However, Ohio is a great place to look because we know that that is going to be very close. These absentee provisional ballots that Robert is talking about, mm-hmm. those don't start to get counted until the 17th of November. So
okay.
that process, we still have to wait for another 2 weeks after the elections are to even begin that process, nonetheless getting fights over whether those ballots are being counted correctly.
Right.
So this, you know, for all the people who talk about, we have eight more days left. This
Not really.
Drag on for a very, very long time. And I think, you know, going to the heart of it, you know, we talk about this in historical terms, right? What mm-hmm. what the founders had in mind, or how this process worked out way, way back in the olden days. But even how it worked out in 2000 is different. 2000, we didn't have Twitter. We didn't have proliferation of blogs. We even cable news was, I mean, it was relatively tame then. Now everybody has a cable channel. So this idea that these electors, these nameless, faceless, whatever electors, that's suddenly going to become an issue too. Who are they? Where do they live?
And they're all pressured all the way along here.
Exactly.
So I'm looking at dates here. December 11th, the safe harbor date, means you know, that a state has chosen its winning slate of electors by that date. So presumably by December 11th, I know, barring court challenges or something else, they have to have said, okay, here's our vote. Here's our electors. December 17th, the date on which the winning slate of electors meets in each state capital to cast their votes. That's the Electoral College vote. And then January 7th, next year, the date that the new Congress would meet in joint session to count the electoral votes. And how does that count work, Robert, for president, for vice president?
Well, if we were to have a tie, if that's what you're looking at,
yep.
That's where the zaniness really, really begins. And most of the polls are looking like the Republicans will maintain the House, and what they would do is vote as each state would have one vote as a House delegation, and it's likely that Mitt Romney, of course, would be chosen as president. But
because just to go slow down on that one, you'd have more state delegations to the House of Representatives with a Republican majority. So likelihood there, if it were a tie, they would go, I mean, unless it all flipped here, and which could happen, but it seems unlikely, they'd probably go for Romney for president.
And that's even fascinating because, you know, you've got California that has over 50 members in the House would have one vote as a member of the House in that delegation, whereas Alaska would have one representative and yet have equal footing in the House on that vote.
Right. So it's a real equalizer as far as states go.
Right.
That vote, and we'll come back and look at how this would work, but that vote would decide the presidency and the vice presidency?
No. You would think it would be a lot easier than that, right? But talk about our separated system. And actually, what you would have are the top three vote earners be the ones that would be among those that could be selected in the House. And it would likely be Mitt Romney. But then we move to the Senate to determine who the vice president would be. And that's where things get even more interesting and a bit nutty with our system.
Because we have a Democratic majority there now, may well have it on the other side of this election. And so people have talked about this, but you could well end up with a President Romney and a vice president from the other party, Biden.
Right. It sounds like a reality TV show, doesn't it?
It's pretty wild. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
Now, along the way, this issue of faithless electors, you know, who are the electors? If it really comes down 269 to 269, you can imagine that both parties would be trying like crazy to find one elector to pop in their direction, to somehow pry out of the expected vote and bring them over. Is that possible, Robert? How could that happen?
It's more possible than I would have ever have thought, and probably most observers of the Electoral College would have ever have thought. A few years back, this is the crux of my research, is on just trying to simply identify who the electors are. Who are these nameless people and faceless people? And most of them are party officials, not all. In doing my research, I could basically find one sentence basically on who the electors are, and they said that they're most likely political hacks and fat cats. And while that's true for a number of them, it's not true for all of them. And what you find is that a number of electors actually have considered voting contrary to expectations. It happens very infrequently. Most electors, of course, follow the herd. But, you know, looking at what we're likely to see if we had a 269 tie, the lobbying efforts on these individuals would be like nothing we've ever seen before. And I have actually seen that electors from 2000, 2004, and even in 2008, when it wasn't particularly a close contest, were lobbied intensely. Over 80% of them were lobbied to change their vote.
So, Amy, can you picture that? Are there?
Yes.
How would that work,
Robert? I think it was in 2008 when the D.C. electors said, "Well, you know what? We're casting our lot with John Edwards as a way to protest the lack of voting rights in the state." We've seen it in, I think, Minnesota at one point. This was it was Minnesota where, in 2004, a faithless elector voted for Edwards. So it's happened. It just hasn't made much of a difference.
But here, all you'd need is one, just one, and that would decide.
And that would do the whole thing. So can you imagine in this day and age, right, where it's 269 to 269, and what sort of intense pressure they would be on? I mean, I would expect that all of them would be put under, you know, Secret Service protection of some sort, because seriously, this could be, you know, the kind of pressure that no human being has been put under.
Unbelievable. Robert, you've got a couple of states where the things work differently. Maine and Nebraska, they're not quite the same as most. What happens there? It's by congressional district?
Yeah, actually, Maine, Nebraska, all the other states in the District of Columbia are winner-take-all. So basically, if the candidate wins or the ticket wins by one vote, you get all of the electoral votes, which causes some of that amplification of electoral votes relative to the popular vote.
Right.
But Maine and Nebraska are a little strange, or some might say a little bit more representative, because what they do is they actually cast their ballots based upon congressional district representation with two additional electoral votes going to the whoever had the highest vote in the state.
Okay.
Interestingly, in 2008, we had a Nebraska legislature, or excuse me, a Nebraska electoral college where there was actually one Obama elector who was elected from the Omaha district. And so that probably made for a little awkward moment there when they cast their ballots. But that actually figures into one of those electoral college tie scenarios, and that is the Romney ticket actually picking off a congressional district in Maine.
Wow. You better believe the buses and limos will be descending on that district that looked vulnerable. Sumner in East Greenwich, Rhode Island. Thanks for calling, Sumner. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Actually, I had called originally about this very Nebraska main issue, which I think is going to be significant. I think that Obama is going to squeak through without the vote for Nebraska.
Okay.
The other issue is what happens in the event of a death of an elector? Because as I understand it, the electors are actually named and elected by name.
So it's not just a number; it's people, in particular people. What if one out of 538 is incapacitated, Robert?
Actually, that's not death, but that's happened quite a bit where electors, due to a snowstorm, for instance, haven't been able to make it to cast their ballot. And generally, what happens is the electors of that state are empowered to select a new elector. And that has happened on a number of occasions, including one where somebody was basically grabbed right through the hallways and said, "Do you want to be an elector?" And I said, "Sure. Who am I supposed to vote for?"
I mean, but there again, exactly, who am I supposed to vote for? There again, that is almost a smoke-filled room way of coming up with that one vote that could change everything one way or another. Hank in Morrisville, Vermont. Hank, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Oh, and I just like to make a comment that if Obama should win the general election vote and it does go to the Electoral College and they elect Mitt Romney, I think you're going to see a great revolt by the American people by their vote no longer counting. And I think we should get away from the Electoral College and just let us U.S. citizens make the call.
What if it goes the other way, Hank? What if it's a President Obama victory in the Electoral College, which, I mean, Nate Silver, New York Times, is keeping track. He says today there's still a 74% chance of that, an Obama Electoral College victory. But as Amy points out, what if it goes that way, but Governor Romney has the popular vote?
I would be very sad that Obama, I want him to win, but if it went that way, I would be very sad because still the American people voted and they should be the deciders, not the Electoral College.
Yeah, it will certainly highlight that. We'll look at that, and I appreciate your call as well, Hank. Kirk in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Kirk, you're on the air.
I'm kind of curious on, is there a possibility that candidates, you know, in all this dispute could bring in the court and tie it up even further?
We'll look at it. Yeah, thanks for the question, Kirk. Amy, what about it? I mean, are there open windows for the courts to get involved here? Can you imagine court challenges in addition to the Electoral College consideration?
You mean, I wonder if what we're talking about is, does the court get involved in terms of
challenges to particular vote tallies around the country?
Yeah, well, each court, I think, you know, we've seen this, as we will see once again in House and Senate races, where the courts do have to get involved in making decisions about ballots and what the interpretation of certain rules are. And look, each state has very specific rules, for example, about when and how an absentee vote can be counted, when it has to be postmarked, date stamped. But as we also know, a lot of these absentee votes, for example, get thrown out because the rules were not followed by the voter, him or herself, right? Oh, you have to sign this. You forgot to sign it. That's canceled out. We can't really tell which one you voted for. So, again, we may be back in that situation. Minnesota is, in my mind, the most recent case where it just dragged out over just weeks and weeks and weeks, a Minnesota Senate race back a few years ago, where it was literally looking at every single one of these absentee votes. That takes a great deal of time. The courts will somehow get involved, yes, in mitigating those disputes.
And if it could be a tie, if people see that possibility, then every vote's going to count. Here, the odds of a court challenge goes up, I would think.
You would think so. And again, there are, you know, every Secretary of State is and should be preparing for the potential for this. But as I said, there are plenty of states that say, listen, we will already have an automatic recount if it's close. But you as a, and in some states, you can request a recount as long as you say you're going to pay for it. In some states, they say, no, you can't just request a recount because you lost.
Yeah, let's hope, let us hope this does not happen. But there are half a dozen ways that it could this election season. Amy Walter, Robert Alexander, please stand by. We're talking about the possibility of an electoral college tie after next week's vote. What's your question on how this would really unfold? Does a tie mean President Romney, Vice President Biden? Do you remember the tension in 2000, how we dealt with it? How would we deal this time? 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're here today with an eye on Hurricane Sandy and also looking at the possibility of another extreme and unusual event, the possibility, remote but not at all out of the question, of a tie in the Electoral College in next week's presidential election, looking very closely at how that would be resolved. When you look, you've got to hope that it does not happen because, you know, in that kind of pressure, things get very, very uncomfortable. The Constitution's got a clear path, but we all know how things get worked. You can join the conversation this hour. What's your question about how this would really unfold? Would a tie mean President Romney, Vice President Biden? Do you remember the tension in 2000? Are you praying we avoid a tie here? 800-423-TALK. Amy Walter is with us. Political director for ABC News joins us from Washington today. And with us from Ada, Ohio, is Robert Alexander of Ohio Northern University, author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. That would be right in the middle of all of this. Of course, all of this coming at the end of a week that's going to be have a hurricane all over it. President Obama and Governor Romney paying a lot of attention to that in the last 24 hours. Extreme and unusual from the weather side. Here's the president at FEMA headquarters in Washington saying people on the East Coast, Mid-Atlantic, need to take this hurricane very seriously.
It's going to be very important that populations in all the impacted states take this seriously. Listen to your state and local elected officials. My message to the governors, as well as to the mayors, is anything they need, we will be there.
And here's Mitt Romney campaigning on a trip through Iowa, Ohio, Wisconsin this weekend with a storm in mind.
I know that right now some people in the country are a little nervous about a storm about to hit the coast, and our thoughts and prayers are with the people who will find themselves in harm's way.
But Amy, Robert, I want to take us back to 2000 and the pressure that blew up there when there was all of that controversy over the hanging chads in Florida, and suddenly that count is up in the air, and the heat and pressure came on so fast. This was November 10th, 2000. This was 3 days after Election Day, after a recount of ballots that gave George W. Bush a 327-vote lead, a very, very narrow lead in Florida. James Baker, the chief legal advisor to the Bush-Cheney campaign, came flying in, held a press conference where he called for an end to the contested election.
To suggest that we should keep counting ballots that have been counted once and even twice over and over again, I think, is not a fair position to take, nor a responsible position to take. And it would be my hope that that the candidate of the other party would acknowledge that.
Amy Walter, the heat came on in such a hurry there. Now, in this case, it was all focused on Florida. If it's this close nationally, there could be potential, you know, balance points all over the country. But think with us for a second about the scenario and how that kind of pure muscle might come into play, be brought to bear. What should we have our eyes open for?
Well, I think you also have to look out for a country that is so polarized and already so cynical about the process, right? And what it would mean, either way, again, whether we have the popular vote, electoral vote split, or we have this debate about the what happens at a 269-269 or battles over recount.
Yep.
I mean, it is going to have repercussions long beyond the end of the campaign. And remember, we are headed into, as we, I know you have talked about, and all of us here in Washington have talked about, something known as the fiscal cliff at the end of this year, where Congress and the White House have have to figure out a way to deal with looming big spending cuts and tax rates going up across the board for pretty much every American. Now, are they going to be able to do this in the midst of what could be an incredibly debilitating and polarizing event like this, whether it's just simply recounts and like we saw in Florida, or whether it is the pressure on these electors, I don't know. But that that really has serious real-world implications for a process that is supposed to start getting underway just a month after the election's over.
Dealing with the fiscal cliff, because people are up against that right at the beginning
exactly.
of the new year.
So right at the end of the year, right? Yeah. So December 31st is when this is all supposed to kick in. Now, can you have cooler heads prevailing in Congress to say, while all this other stuff is going on, we're still dealing with great uncertainty as to who the next president of the United States is, the current president and the current Congress have to deal with this. That could be just another tension point in what we know is a very high-stakes game of chicken about real consequences for not dealing with the tax issue and not dealing with these spending cuts.
Boy, it sure would be. Robert Alexander, give us a little historical perspective in terms of the pressure cooker that would present. Has the country dealt with that before?
Well, let me go back to 2000. It's mm-hmm. pretty recent, and I think that one of the things you look at is that in 2004, we almost expected a cauldron of lawyers to send upon, you know, the next potential hot spot, which was Ohio, again, in 2004.
Because 2000 had been just so unsettling and left so many really bad feelings.
Well, it seemed like the expectation was, well, we're going to have another, you know, popular electoral college vote split, and we almost did. John Kerry, had he won another 1.5% of votes in Ohio, we would have had a Democrat, John Kerry, who would have carried the Electoral College but lost the popular vote. So we almost had two misfires in a row.
Mm-hmm.
If you add one extra little piece to this, generally what we find is that about 2% of those ballots that are cast are typically not counted for all kinds of reasons. And, Amy had talked about the Minnesota recounts a few years back. I mean, we could be in store for something like that all over the place, especially given a number of changes in whether it's absentee voting, provisional ballots. I mean, there's, you know, voter ID. It's ripe for it.
But votes things. Not counted 2% for what kind of reason?
Because, there was not a clear mark on the ballot.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they're normally distributed, that shouldn't be a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Except, once again, we want to have some faith and legitimacy in the electoral process. The Electoral College, while it's there to preserve federalism and perhaps the two-party system, it does raise a lot of concerns and questions about one's voting legitimacy.
I mean, we've had other presidents, Rutherford B. Hayes, 1876, Benjamin Harris, 1888, won the Electoral College even though they lost the popular vote. But this tie with the 12th Amendment in the middle of it, we're on new territory here. Sky in Iowa City, Iowa. Sky, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I had a quick question.
Yeah.
Why is it that we have an even number of electoral votes? Why do we even allow ourselves to be put in a situation where we can have a tie? If we just had an odd number of electoral votes, we wouldn't have this crazy system for dealing with it. It
does seem like a nutty design, doesn't it, Sky? That's a good question, Robert. How about it? Why?
Well, there's been no other institution in the United States that has received more proposals to amend it than the Electoral College. Nearly 1,000 proposals. That's been among them. But it doesn't even have to be a tie. The reason here is, I mean, we don't have a strong third-party candidate in this election. The idea is really that nobody receives a majority of the electoral votes. And this is why we're focused on the tie in this instance. But it very well could be that we could have a viable third-party candidate come in 4 years from now and deny anybody a majority of the electoral votes, which
we've seen that with Ross Perot and Bill Clinton's first victory by a plurality, not a majority.
Right, right. Well, and even then, Ross Perot, you had 19% of Americans vote for him, yet he received no electoral votes whatsoever.
Ken, in Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Ken, you're on the air.
Good morning. I can't tell if the last caller made this point, but I'll make it very quickly. There is a reason why we have an even number of electoral votes. We have an odd number of representatives in Congress, 435, and you add 100 to that from the Senate. That gives you 535. For most of American history, we've had an odd number of electoral votes. But when D.C. was allowed to vote for president, they were given three electoral votes. The stipulation in the amendment is that they cannot have more than the state with the least number of votes, and that's three. If D.C. had actually been allowed to have the number of electoral votes their population would allow, they'd have four. And if D.C. had four, we'd have an odd number of votes in the Electoral College, and the possibility of a tie with a two-party system would be very remote. There's the source of the problem.
So there's an explanation, Robert. D.C. comes in, gets the vote, three electoral votes, and we no longer have that. It wasn't so badly designed to begin with, but that's where we've ended up, I guess.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other issue is the idea of, like, what representation ought to be like. And as your caller rightly points out, the District of Columbia can have no more electoral votes than the state with the least number of electoral votes, which, of course, and Amy pointed that out earlier as well, that an elector in 2000 abstained. In that closely contested race, abstained to protest the lack of voting rights for the district.
Amy, where do you see, if political heat comes in here again, where do you think this will be most vulnerable? I mean, when James Baker showed up in Florida, you know, and of course he had been so prominent in Bush Sr.'s administration, and he came in just sort of waving that large and in charge kind of reputation. And we saw, what was it, you know, the folks who were kind of busting into the counting facilities there. I mean, it got weird. Where do you think the application of political muscle might be most likely if all anybody needs is one more electoral vote to break a tie?
Well, so I think if you, let's just play out a couple of scenarios. If indeed the counts hold up in all the different states, we make it through that process, the pressure on the individual electors, I think, is going to be something like we've never seen before. So that is going to be amazing, intense, and I think we could write novels about what that could look like. But before we get to that, let's just mm-hmm. get to the place where we have too close to call elections in these states. As we saw with Florida, who the Secretary of State is matters. How that Secretary of State carries out the process matters. How the campaigns understand and work with and manipulate, in many cases, the current law matters. So, you know, you can look back for all the folks who remember 2000, the people who wrote the articles and the books about 2000. You know, it really came down to the fact that there were plenty of opportunities throughout for one of those various pieces to have an undue influence, whether it was the elected official, whether it was the decision by the campaigns, the strategy behind what the campaigns asked for and how it worked, and the individual laws by each county, not just by state. So, you know, look, this is why you have both campaigns lawyering up, so to speak, in all of these battleground states. I know that those of us in the news business are also getting all of our smart legal folks on the ground very well read in to how this process works by state.
Yeah.
And then the campaigns themselves, because they've been through this before, they know what they need to do. But you're right. I mean, if we're really looking at state by state, county by county, precinct by precinct, you know, debates about individual ballots, this is going to take a lot longer than what we saw, potentially even than what we saw in 2000.
Let us hope it doesn't go that way. We're looking at the possibility, remote but real, of a tie in the Electoral College. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Carl in Ithaca, New York, is calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. The Electoral College is criticized. It's really not democratic. And it would require a constitutional amendment to change it. However, some states are do give the electors proportionally, which I think would be much more a reflection of the popular vote. I don't know how realistic it is to think that more states would do this. It's only a few at this point. But would that not change this thing? And I also want to make a point about what your guest just mentioned about the Secretary of State in both Florida and then, I guess, 4 years later in Ohio, really tweaked the elections. And it looks to me like the state Democrats have gotten ahead of the curve on that, but we'll see.
Well, Carl, let us pick it up. Robert, in some move to tie this more closely to a popular vote, so or even just go to a popular vote so we could escape this kind of prospect?
Well, I think that the Constitution, it'd be really difficult to ratify an amendment on a popular vote. There is an organization, the National Popular Vote Campaign, that is actually has an ingenious scheme to tie the winner of the popular vote to the Electoral College in such a way as to have a compact where whenever the winner of the popular vote is determined, then the states that are drawn into that compact, whether or not their candidate actually won or not, would then send their Electoral College votes for the winner of the popular vote. And this is a way to actually circumvent the Constitution by using a state compact. And that also speaks to the idea that really what's going on here is that the states are pretty much in control of this process. If you were to take a look at the idea of proportional representation or district representation, that was Maine and Nebraska's decision. It's Ohio's decision. It's Florida's decision. And so that's really up to the state legislatures to make that call.
Is there any law against wooing electors? I mean, can you say, hey, do you want to be ambassador to such and such country, or here's a ranch in Wyoming?
Interestingly, what you find is that there is a handful of laws that actually penalize faithless voting. A majority of the states have laws that will bind or ask electors to take a pledge, but that still leaves about 20 states that do not have that. Those states that penalize electors typically enacted those laws after they had a faithless elector, so they actually did it after the fact.
Wow. Robert Alexander at Ohio Northern University, author of Presidential Electors and the Electoral College. It's been great to have you with us this hour. We hope that your expertise does not come fully into play next week. But thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, it would be great for me, but bad for the country.
Yeah,
thanks,
yeah.
Thanks
we're with you with that. Thank you. And Amy, can you see out the window there? Is the hurricane on you yet?
Well, so the wind is picking up a little bit. The rain is coming down hard. By 2 o'clock, apparently, is when we're supposed to get the winds. I'm looking out the window at a very large tree. And I'm hoping it stays in place.
Let's hope it stays right there and things don't get too wild before or in this election. Amy Walter is political director for ABC News, joining us from Washington today. Amy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, too. And you guys stay safe up in the Northeast.
We'll try.
Next to you.
We'll try. Asbury Park, New Jersey, in the teeth of this storm, 1973, Bruce Springsteen wrote about Sandy. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.